This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
I quoted Lao Tzu earlier on. A leader is best when people barely know he exists, when his work is done, his aims fulfilled, and they say we did it ourselves. I think this really applies to our conversationalist in today's leadership dialogue. We know his name. We kind of know his name, but we don't really pay attention. He barely exists. And yet his work is done. His aims fulfilled. His aims fulfilled. And when we look at some of his contributions, we own them collectively and say, we did this ourselves. And that's what you call leading from the back. There is another famous quote that says a leader is also a follower. You know, it's very important. You've got to be able to be in the trenches if you're a leader, not just the general giving the instructions, driving the strategy. And ultimately, this is just about your work speaking for itself. And I think it's very true for Saki Makozoma, the executive chairman of Safika Holdings. He's also a former political prisoner and was quite instrumental in drafting ANC economic policy as well many years ago. So, yes, this is an opportunity for nostalgia, meandering down memory lane. But I'd also like to focus on the fundamentals of how we create an inclusive economy, one that nurtures the creation of a solid middle class, a merchant class that holds generation after generation and even grows. I want us to talk about creating intergenerational wealth for Black South Africans. And I want to talk about creating legacies, real legacies for posterity. So the warmest welcome.
Thank you.
Saki Makozoma.
Thank you so much. Interesting quote.
Yes. And I think it does apply to you because we know you as a doyen of business. We know you as a Robben Island prisoner, stalwart, activist. But we don't see you and we're okay with it because we know you're there. And yet when the moment arises and we say, where are the people who need to say something about the situation? Then your name comes up. Bapi or Saki, Bapi or. So we know you're there. But we focus on perhaps your work and what you've done. Is that how you live your life?
I'm quite comfortable with the position that you've described. And I think the quote you started with is very apt in the sense that it's not about the noise factor, I think, that people have influence. And some people have influence just by being there. You know, I remember being in the U.S. during the Obama first, the Obama years. Yes. And somebody made the comment that in the halls of power in the world and in Europe and everywhere else, his mere presence in the room without him saying anything would tilt the conversation, would tilt the atmosphere in the right kind of direction. So I do believe that it's not attributing to individuals. Ultimately, when a society works well, it is because a combination of influences, particularly of people who are felt but not seen, is what is at work. But I haven't gone deliberately to taking a view that I should be invisible. Yeah. But at the same time, I have decidedly that. It is better for me not to make noise. One is much more effective, I think, when your ideas are reflected by other people, so that, as the quote says, people can say none but ourselves have done it.
However, you haven't been completely silent in recent years. It was just last year that you shared some thoughts at the Desmond and Lea Tutu Legacy Foundation. And there you said something quite simple but poignant about ethical leadership. Absence of critical leadership and the truth in South Africa was a talk you gave and interventions you made. And I'm underscoring the absence. What has led to the absence of ethical and critical leadership in this moment in time in South Africa?
I often ponder that to go to the roots of what has gone wrong with our society. The easy analytical and maybe the lazy analytical route to take is say, oh, apartheid did this to us. But the reality is that parallel to apartheid and over and above the apartheid impact on us, it has also been the situation that we're in a society that my interests supersede everybody's interests. Yeah. And I make an example of that, not because of the current strike,
yeah,
that growing up in Port Elizabeth, when you started seeing the bed sheets of Livingston Hospital being drying in the yards of people, yeah, people kept quiet.
Yeah.
And they expected, at that time, people had an excuse to say, oh, well, this isn't our government, we're redistributing, etc., etc. But if we had said something then to say, you cannot take the bed sheets or the food of patients in the hospital and take them to your home,
yeah,
and believe that that is correct. There are many examples of that kind of thing that over time, our society has become relatively unethical, and you cannot expect a population that is generally unethical to produce ethical politicians.
It's an interesting thing you're saying, because often when we talk about the lack of ethical leadership, it's top down. We look at leadership and then we say, what is the impact of that on society? And what you've done today is you flip that. You've said, no, before we even get to Mahlambandlovu and what we think is happening in government, can we look at what we say about ethical leadership and how we as ordinary men and women conduct ourselves?
Precisely.
And if you're buying bedsheets stolen from a hospital, you need to look yourself squarely in the mirror. And I think this is an important thing, because that's the conversation that many South Africans are not ready to have.
Yes, I also think, I guess the responsibility of leadership also is to frame the questions of the moment. And I think that as those we classify as leaders, one of the things that we're not doing is to frame the issues and to make sure that these debates are happening in society. They are happening in wherever people gather. Mm. You know, our response to this kind of things some years back was to organize the moral regeneration movement. I remember Father Mkhatshwa at some point was leading that, but it never really got to the levels where it should get to, you know, the burial society, the soccer club, the school, you know, where actually people are gathered, even the family, where people are gathered, where you say these values are important. You cannot bring a stolen radio, TV into my home. And you know, in the past, if I went to school and came back with somebody's blazer, that would not leave there, you know, you would be asked and compelled to go and take it back, because you can't bring something that doesn't belong here and doesn't belong to you.
Respect, courtesy,
consideration,
accountability. It begins in the home.
Yeah.
It begins in the community. If you're living in a community where you're protecting the drug dealer who lives at number 63 and you all know him, can't complain about the police not here policing.
Not only protecting them, but leaving off the proceeds and the largesse, and this is worldwide, by the way, and the largesse of the drug dealer, and drug dealers know this very well, that because of the failure of governance and the failure of they will always be providers in the communities in which they actually destroy.
Robin Hoods.
And I remember, you know, an argument with neighbors in Kwazakhele when I was a kid. And people would clean their yards and then take the rubbish and put it in the street. And my argument was, if you think you deserve to live in a space that is clean, why do you think that the public does not deserve the same right that you claim for yourself? Mm. And it's also understanding those interconnections that leaders ought to be cultivating in people so they can make the connections between these things.
And I think this also goes to conduct even in places like Parliament. Decorum.
Yes.
There's a way to argue and say, I don't agree with you.
Precisely.
I don't have to grab you by the scruff of your neck.
No. And I really decry the how that has gone. And, you know, Parliament is one example that we see every year, you know, around the state of the nation. But if you look at political party congresses where chairs have to be chained down because the behavior of people cannot be relied upon. Their consciences cannot be relied upon to do this. But I remember the Youth League conference in Bloemfontein where this thing started, and the leadership of the ANC at that time turned their back and endorsed that conference, even though they knew how it had happened. Mm. Unfortunately, these things have a way of multiplying and becoming a common fungus, if you like, across society. Yeah.
And common fungus, a cancer, and some people will say this is when the snake starts to eat its own head.
Power Talk, the leadership dialogue.
Yes, it is a leadership dialogue with the esteemed Saki Macozoma, doyen of business, political activist, former Robben Islander, and a sage. I really say a sage because we don't hear much from him. I think he's one of those people who, those uncles in the room, he doesn't say much. He observes. And then when he speaks, that was the sense that was needed to just get everybody thinking through their ethics at that point in time. Neba Lamani says, I agree with Butsaki when he says you can't expect a generally unethical population to choose ethical leaders. They can't hold them to a higher standard. But here's my question, says Neba. Doesn't that absolve leadership from influencing the behavior of people? And Lerato, I really admire that man, says Neba. So just because people haven't defined their parameters of ethics doesn't mean leaders should be let off the hook.
No, it doesn't mean it at all. And I agree with Neba, and thanks for his comments. I do think though that we should moderate our expectations in terms of the leaders that we're going to get. But it does not necessarily mean that each and every person that is in leadership is of that ilk. It's a matter of balance in the society, and those leaders who are not of that ilk are the ones that bear the responsibility of making sure that the tilt in the leadership is not in the wrong direction, and that, in fact, by example and by persuasion, by their leadership skills, they should be able to tilt the society in the opposite direction. Otherwise, there's no point in there being leaders.
I'm sure you've heard the psychology thesis around nature and nurture. It's either you're born a particular way or an environment influences you to be a particular way. So when we look at the current cohort of leaders within the ANC, all of them, newly appointed NEC, National Working Committee, and yes, there are many people of questionable character and not even questionable character in parlance, they've been named in a Zondo Commission and many other reputable bodies. Do you think that the values of that crop of ANC leaders has started to influence the environment? Or do you think there was always a deficiency anyway within the ANC? So let me be more direct. People say, oh, Cyril Ramaphosa is a good guy. He's a really nice guy. What's happening to him is a reflection of the people he's surrounded by, as if he doesn't have agency.
Yes, it's an interesting topic. At some point, I thought I'd write about it.
Oh, please do.
Because I don't think that it is helpful to characterize the ANC leadership. There are many ANCs and there are many ANC leaderships. Leadership groups and styles and all of that. And I always find sometimes, particularly those who claim to be the opposition, that they aid and abet the bad elements because it makes them feel good.
Okay.
Our emphasis should be to be saying, if Cyril Ramaphosa is a good man and someone else, Malcolm X, is a good man in the ANC. So let's not condemn the ANC. Let's make sure that we support those in the ANC that actually are good for the country. and support those policies that are good for the country, in as much as we oppose those. Alan Kirkland Soga, who published a newspaper in East London in the 1890s, used to have a slogan in his paper that said, against the wrong that means resistance, for the good that lacks assistance.
Yeah.
That should be our attitude in this light.
So basically reiterating that view that evil prevails when good men are silent. So create an environment where the good men can drown out the voices of evil.
And find them everywhere, because they are everywhere. There is a defeatism in a sense of saying, oh, we're overwhelmed. All the ANC is overwhelmed by the thieves and the thugs and the those who don't even know where they are. Mm. But the fact of the matter is that we need to work with what we have. We are not going to find a situation where we find from some hothouse new people, a new cadre, as Thabo Mbeki once put it in 1980 when he was talking about the direction the ANC was taking. We're not going to find that kind of thing. We have to create it. We have to work with the material that we've got.
Right.
And part of that is identify the good people from the bad people.
So very briefly, and your life obviously has had many ebbs and flows, and this is not to simplify it, but 1977, you were firebrand, activist, politician, and ultimately you were arrested and in school uprisings and found yourself at Robben Island. So you've done the hard yards. You've been in the trenches, as they say. So what do you make of the newer generation of firebrand young leaders around us who may talk the talk but sometimes don't walk the walk? And to be simple, some people say people are busy calling themselves veterans when they are hardly 40 years of age. You know, how does that make you feel?
It happens in a way. I think in the first time I noticed that, and I guess the world was Zimbabwe, when all of a sudden a group of people were congregating against certain politicians that purported to be coming up with radical solutions, and the easiest thing for them to do was to call themselves veterans. But I think that every generation produces its leadership. Part of the responsibility of the previous leadership, including myself, is to have made sure that the next generation of leadership had imbibed, understood, and accepted, and was willing to propagate and to defend the values that we believed in. And I think as a generation, we failed to do that. And I think that we allowed a situation where some people will argue that getting the numbers, say, for instance, of the Youth League in order to get elected, got into the way of saying this behavior and that behavior is not allowed in the ANC and should not be sanctioned. So with, you know, leaders sold political support, sold the values for political support at elections at certain points
so
in their lives.
So this is passing the baton, hasn't happened, succession planning, and more importantly, there's a pursuance of quantity, not quality. We'll continue in a moment. Nyakalo Tefo, over to you.
Power Talk, the leadership dialogue.
And a leader so revered, respected by many, and it's coming through in the comments online. Aubrey Sidubani says, a beautiful interview with Mr. Makozoma. His societal moral fabric analysis is top level, he says in capital letters. I once asked myself a question about us as individuals. Are we born immoral or not? My biblical sense, Aubrey, is that apparently we're all born sinners. The whole journey of life is to become a better version of yourself. He says it's a good conversation. Big ups to Power FM. And we thank Mr. Makozoma for allowing us an hour of his time today. Before the news headlines, he was reminding us about a few things that the society of South Africa needs to introspect on: what our own moral persuasions are and whether we can form and weave a tapestry of values that would define us as South Africans. You know, the way Americans despite everything that's happening in America. But when they show up in the world, they say, I'm an American because, and they start to rattle down a litany of values that makes them Americans. Can we get to that point as South Africans when we say, despite what's happening in South Africa, I'm a South African because these are the values we share in common? And then he's also said that when you look at, I'm going to call them false prophets, young leaders coming up, talking the talk, but not walking the walk. It's also a function of not passing the baton. It's also a function of the leaders of old not really sufficiently preparing a new cohort of leaders. And you will know that Saki Magozuma can say this because he was once a student leader. And for his activism, found himself on Robben Island. And many, many years later, even after 1994, he didn't enter business. He entered business long after being in politics. And so my question is, when he looks at the caliber of leaders today, what does he think? And that's the conversation we're having. You know, I went to Robben Island for the first time last year. I'd always taken it for granted. And it was quite moving when I got there. Former Robben Islanders sharing their experiences that even in a prison situation, there's a segregation of black prisoners, white prisoners, black prisoners, Indian prisoners, colored prisoners. They segregate the food, what the black prisoners can eat. The uniform that the colored and Indian prisoners in winter could wear, long johns and long pants and jerseys. And you all still had to wear shorts and walk barefooted.
Well, fortunately, many of those battles have been fought and won, I mean, around clothing. But when I arrived there in 1977, the food discrimination, you know, colored prisoners would get milk and bread, and you'd get a pap or something. So we did ask the head of prison to explain to us whether different races have got different gastronomical systems that prescribe that you know, there should be discrimination in diet. And the response we got was quite hilarious. Of course, we'd expected that. There was no real response to that other than that culturally you are accustomed to what we feed you. So, you know, you're not going to come to jail here and then you want more things
eggs.
And eat eggs when in fact culturally you are, well, but I'm grateful for the fact that they did not segregate. All black people were together. The only prisoners that were not there were white prisoners.
Yes.
And I think that was that gave us a great sense of cohesion as in the struggle, because we shared a lot across the ethnic divide, so to say, and it would have been a tragedy if they had separated the Indians and the so-called coloreds from the so-called African prisoners. So that togetherness actually produced a lot of camaraderie and also solidified the leadership over the years. Mm.
And just for context, white prisoners were sent to like Pretoria Prison or Kroonstad or whatever. They weren't brought to Robben Island.
They were not brought to Robben Island. In fact, the Robben Island was very clear. If you're white, you're a warder. If you're black, you're a prisoner. No gray area.
What do you make of people who say, look at the parlous state of service delivery. Look at this infrastructure. Look at these potholes. Look at the refuse not collected. Life was better under apartheid. For somebody who served time as a prisoner, a political prisoner, when you hear that...
Well, It hurts sometimes. I mean, it depending on who says it and how they say it. It hurts when a person who actually was a beneficiary and a perpetrator of injustice says something like that, because they have no basis, at all to be able to understand what it could have been. So there's that. For those who were victims of apartheid. You know, it's interesting because when Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt, there were those who said as soon as the first trouble came, it was better in Egypt. So this is not a new concept. It was better in Egypt. Why did you take us? In fact, they fought with him. Why did you take us out of Egypt? At least there we had food. And so this is a common thing. And then you can look across generations and epochs. you will find examples of those who want to go back to Egypt, so to say. What I think they should be directing their anger at is, why is it that we have the kinds of things that we do, or the lack that we have? Who has elected the people? And all of those will point at them and how they exercise the freedom that they have had. And there are two options there. And I'm not saying that they should necessarily vote against that party or for that party. I'm saying if they believe in the ANC or in EFF, whatever they believe in, they must get in there and get their hands dirty and fix it. And not sit under a tree and say, oh, it's bad in this country, as if they don't themselves have the agency to make the change. And one of the things that I think I actually objected to right at the beginning was the emergence of the word in South Africa, delivery. Delivery means you sit under a tree, you're a wheelbarrow. You sit under a tree and you wait for somebody else to deliver to you. And you're not part of, so you must deliver jobs. But the person to whom the job has been delivered has no obligation to enable themselves to be a productive part of that job.
Yeah, rights versus responsibilities. Yeah. Right? You want your rights, you have a responsibility in amplifying those rights and making sure it works. I don't want to belabor this point a little bit. I remember Matthews Poso once saying, what boggles his mind, he told me this when I was still at BBC on my show, is when he was growing up as a young man in that apartheid South Africa, you knew that come age 21, you try and work and save so that when you're ready to pay lobola for a woman, you've got something in the kitty to go and build a house for your new family. That's manhood. And today, people are waiting for an RDP house. And he finds it mind-boggling. And I think it spoke to this idea of entitlement. What do you make of people who say there's a culture that's crept into South Africa called entitlement, and that's why this kind of agency you're talking about doesn't exist?
I agree with Matthew Poss, but I think he should be saying that he and I and others created, nurtured, and supported this idea that a man can go into the streets and hold a placard and say, I want a house, and the government has not delivered a house to me. Or alternative, when the government has delivered a house, they'll say, it's not big enough, no, I've got two wives now, kind of thing. So I think we've created that, but we were well-intentioned, I think. The intention was to say apartheid is created, has arrested our development so much that our people need the support that the government can offer them in order to make sure that they build on top of that and actually build their lives.
Right.
But the notion then that actually the government's built me a house, it must feed me, it must provide me, any and everything that I have, is actually a major, major problem.
So here's the issue. Somebody would listen to you now and say, that's all good and well. Even though you were a student activist, you went to Robben Island, etc., you eventually were able to get an education. Because you were part of the ANC, you were then able to be networked. And then ultimately, when black economic empowerment was forged as a policy, you were then deployed into business. And today you're a millionaire. So you can talk about entitlement because you've made your money.
You know, it starts for me, it starts on Robben Island. I went to Robben Island, I had no matric. And I wrote my matric on Robben Island and passed. I was refused permission to study for 3 years. On my last year before my release, I started a degree at UNISA and finished it in 3 years. On Robben Island, there were people who had the same opportunity, the same books, the same. And when we were studying, some of them were saying, what's the point of studying? Because socialism is coming, we'll all be equal. Ultimately, I think everybody has got to ask themselves, what is it that they have done or not done? If I had chosen that route, I probably would have come out and be a marshal in the ANC. But I chose and I exerted myself. And I made sure that I was prepared even for the society that I wanted to contribute to it with some skills. And therefore, when many people like of my generation and ilk are now in positions of power and influence, it is not necessarily correct that they were put there without effort. It may be the case in later iterations of empowerment, but I think people should take into account that there is a lot of hard work that goes into these things.
You say people. Many of your colleagues said, there's no point in applying yourself. We're going to just be revolutionary. Socialism is coming. Well, socialism sort of came in the form of a national democratic revolution, but the RDP was quickly replaced by GEAR, and now we're sitting with a fairly neoliberal economy that has actually widened the chasms of inequality as opposed to creating a more inclusive economy. What do you make of the evolution of the new South Africa?
Well, let's start with economic policy. I don't think that there is a mutual exclusion between the RDP and GEAR. I think that they are opposite ends of one policy, in my view. And if you look at the historical evidence of the growth that followed, the clarity that came with GEAR, it's very clear that those two went together and should never be separated. Insofar as where we are today, I think that we were on a good path for some time. Of course, there is a propitiousness about these things, that the world economy, the winds are behind you rather than in front of you. But if you don't prepare yourself to take advantage of favorable winds, you cannot then blame anybody for that. So I believe that we started very well. For instance, let's take examples of new industries. We were at sunset industries in the mining industry. We knew that. We then started ICTs. If you look at Vodacom, MTN, Cell C, and all of those, and a lot of industries, they were not there.
In 94.
Discovery. Look at how big they are. Medical Discovery. Sense, yeah. Look at how big they are today. And so we did take advantage because we were ready and prepared to do that. And we had the right policies for doing that. But what we did not do is understanding that actually to maintain that, we needed consistent policy clarity. We needed competent people to carry out that policy. We needed a population that understands the choices that need to be made in society in order to grow consistently. And until we understand that, and then we substituted that by going back to pre-liberation rhetoric about, oh, the problem is with the white people, or the problem is racism. And I have a view that the people in Southeast Asia didn't sit there and say, oh, we would like Europeans and Caucasians to love us. They created an economy that the Caucasians cannot ignore. We must stop this thing of blaming everything on white people.
Earlier on, when I spoke about BEE, I said, you know, it's what we call it in South Africa, but it's got its own iterations in Malaysia. It's in China and many economies of the world, local participation, local ownership. And it's worked. The transformation of China is because the Chinese were very deliberate that the Chinese must own a share of the means of production and then phase out everybody else who's not meant to be there. Why is it not working in South Africa? Because again, here we are almost 30 years later. There's been BEE. The economy still looks very much in terms of ownership the way it did pre-1994. It's still white majority owned. In fact, white people have become four times richer in a democratic South Africa than they ever were before South Africa. And it's created, a handful is an exaggeration, but very few black industrialists, millionaires, and even that black middle class at 11%, it's way too small to transform the economy.
Yeah, I think I want to tackle this question firstly. It's with the fact that white South Africans of a certain class of category have become four times richer. That is partly a function of the growth of the economy. You know, if the economy grows, those who are will become far farmer. But also, I think we should also accept that the innovation of the creation of For instance, of the investment in Tencent in China, and the creation of the multi choices of this world, that, those kinds of things, that we should acknowledge. It is true that the speed at which the participation of black people in the economy has slowed down, in fact, if not reversed in certain respects. But that is also a function of growth. We have to accept that you will be able to deal either with abject poverty or a more stable and secure middle class if there is growth. And therefore, in as much as we should be claiming for consumption purposes what we're claiming, we have to be thinking about productivity in this society. We have to be thinking about new sectors and new, we have to be thinking about new skills. We have to be thinking about the sunset industries and what we replace the sunset industries with. And all of those combine into a cauldron, if you don't, of confusion and rancor, if you actually don't clarify what needs to be done.
All right, we're in conversation with Saki Makozuma. We'll continue in a moment.
Power Talk, the leadership dialogue.
Rato, it's Arthur here from Johannesburg. You've got a great man indeed there in studio. I would never forget what he has done for me personally in life when he was one of the shareholders in one of the medical companies that I worked for, and the behind the scenes things that they've done and the proceeds that came out of that, till to this day I'm grateful for. And thank you very much for bringing that giant in studio. Have a great day.
We're in conversation with Saki Makozuma, and I'm reading between the lines that you negotiated a very important broad-based employee share scheme that then meant that many of them could benefit as well, even till today, is what I'm hearing in that voice note. Hamlet, good morning.
Good morning to you, Radha Nukutsaki. You know, I agree with what Nukutsaki is saying, that, you know, there are good men in every sphere of our society. We need to find them. And when you find them, you know, then we can create an environment of a proper, you know, moral and ethical fiber that our society can be anchored on. And why I believe that, because of when you look at when BAP was formed in Singapore, you know, the ethos of that party, you find resonance across society that is not only top down but is bottom up. Okay. And I think that it's something that is doable. As a people in South Africa, we can lament and throw our hands in the in the sky and say that there's nothing we can do about challenges of South Africa.
Thanks for that, but Hamlet. Desiree, good morning.
Good morning, Lorato. Good morning to Mr. Makozuma. Thank you so much for a very insightful interview. However, I've got a couple of questions, and thank you to Mr. Makozuma for being so honest with regards to the failures.
Sis Desiree, in the interest of time, only one question. So what's the most important question?
The most important question is that as the stalwarts of the ANC, as they see the country going into decay, what are they doing?
Okay. And Stephen Diepkloof, also one question, please, sir.
Yeah. Well, Lerato, you know, for me, the question is, did he cross the floor to the ANC because it's cold outside the ANC, period?
Thank you. Okay, are you ready to answer those? Stalwarts of the ANC, when you watch the ANC in decline, what do you do? What are you doing about it?
A lot of people are doing a lot of things, including the organization of the veterans of the ANC. But I think we should also be mindful of the fact that there's a lot that's going on in the background to try, particularly in the effort to make the renewal idea a reality. Certainly, you know, my view was, my own personal choice was, I don't want to get involved in national ANC politics. Mm. But where I come from, whether it is Port Elizabeth or it is Johannesburg, and people that I've been with school and university with, or Robin Iron with, you know, I do what I have to do. So I think the fact that people may not be visible does not necessarily mean that they're not doing something.
They're silent.
Yeah.
Okay. And crossing the floor, so long-serving member of the ANC, revolutionary, then there's a ruckus, then you leave, then you come back. What's going on?
Look, I think the critical thing at that time was that it got to a point where one said, not in my name. Mm. I just can't stay, I can't just sit there and do nothing. And any other method that I could have used was not available. And therefore, one has to take a view. The Americans I like because they make the point that, we don't have permanent friends, but we have permanent interests. Ultimately, my permanent interest is the Republic of South Africa and its people. And that is the most important thing in my life.
And we've got one last question from Neo, and I think it's backed up by Masingita. Neo, just wait, please. Masingita says, how does Mr. Maxosoma respond to the view that BEE was conceived by big business with the view to capture influential politicians of that democratic era and so that they could access policymakers of the time and mollycoddle and influence the status quo? So BEE was about white business making sure that a new black government serves their interests. What do you say to that theory, says Masingita? And I think Newa has a similar sort of thing.
Well, I think
Just please hold on. Newa's got the question. Go ahead.
Hello, Lerato. Oh, I was going to say, Mr. Maxosoma, with regard to BEE as a beneficiary, I don't like that part of it. But for leadership, I take my hats off. For leadership, this guy, I take my hats off. Compared to what you have now, visionary, committed, incorruptible, that's my comment.
Thanks so much. Newa had just said to the producers, however, he is a beneficiary of BEE. How does he feel when other people can't quite come into the ownership levels of the economy?
I think it would be ridiculous of me not to accept that I am a beneficiary of BEE. I'm also a co-creator of the BEE. I was part of the BEE Commission. I was part of the ANC Economic Transformation Commission and all of those. But the notion that because one was part of those, therefore, somebody then deliver in a wheelbarrow BEE opportunities to me or anybody else is nonsensical. There is a book that's been published about ANC billionaires,
yes,
whose narrative, and fortunately the book doesn't say so, but the way it is positioned is that a number of people were handpicked by big capital in order to influence the policy of the ANC. Anybody who understands policy making in the ANC knows that there's no such a thing. And the sequencing of the existence of the BEE policy and the negotiations with big capital and the state is actually out of sync in terms of that theory. It's a fiction.
As we wind down our conversation, here we are. You said we must work with what we have. So with what we have, what can South Africa do?
I think it's been captured in the course of the conversation by also one of the listeners who sent in a comment, and that is, let's find the good people in society and let's mobilize those people. Let's make sure that their influence preponderates over those that are the bad people in society. That's the only course we have.
Saki Maxosoma, I thank you for your time. It's been deep, it's been poignant, it's been insightful, and it's just been such an easy conversation, and I really want to thank you for coming through. I'm going to take this opportunity to gloat because Mulelekeng Hlopane says, oh, Lerato, the second I hear the name Maxosoma, a beautiful song by the legendary Ntate Tshepo Tshola comes to mind. Indlala, she says, for having such a business icon who rarely does interviews, but bless you with the full hour. Indeed, Lerato, you are the queen of hearts. So thank you for
thank
boosting
you,
my kudos. Thank you,
thank
Saki
so
Maxosoma, doyen of business, and also account director at Standard Bank, former chairperson of Liberty, chairperson of Vodacom, political prisoner, leader in our midst, and one of the ethical good guys around us.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.